Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 165 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Rob Chapman shares the importance of wholly invented bands and songs in his creative life and considers other examples of imaginary culture and the fictitious within our fictions. Here's Rob with Imagined Musics.
For me, the most memorable moment in Stanley Kubrick's film adaptation of Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange occurs when Alex, fresh from another night of dystopian brutality, visits the shopping arcade and meets two girls at the record bar. It's not the chat up itself that I like, it's the top 10 chart on the counter. It contains 10 fictitious records by 10 fictitious groups, one of which, the Heaven 17, is where the 1980s band Heaven 17, minus the definite article, took their name from. A Clockwork Orange is rich in verbal ingenuity, from the sinister Russian-inflected Drew speak to the stimulants, Moloko Plus, Synthmesque, etc., but it's that top 10 list that I always come back to. The Blow Goes, The Sparks, Johnny Zhivago, Goggly Gogol, etc. Those names echo the linguistic modernity of their time, and as a result they sound of their time now, rooted to their era and slightly dated. But being fictitious means that the artists can sound any way you want them to sound. You are never going to hear them, they don't perform in the film, the only performance they give will take place in your head. Such evocations of imaginary music have fed into my own writing for a long time now. They have become an integral part of my repertoire. In my as-yet-unpublished novel Z-Pop, which is set in a parallel now, I have a fictitious top 10 in every chapter, and there are 20 chapters. I had great fun making up 200 song titles for 200 fictional bands. In fact, sometimes the song titles were so good and resonated with such immense possibility that I took them out of the book and put them to one side, with the intention of writing the song that went with that great title. I do actually write songs. I used to be a lead singer and lyricist with a band. So imaginary songs isn't a displacement activity for me. It's a conceptual adjunct to what I've been doing for years. Songwriting is where this all began for me. I started writing my own songs at quite an early age, 9 or 10. Usually, I only ever got as far as a title, a verse and a chorus before they petered out. I rarely completed them and they weren't any good, of course they weren't, I was 9 or 10. But the thrill of creating, of inventing, of thinking I could join in with a pop world that I could only otherwise view from afar, was even at that tender age its own reward. But then I stopped, the novelty wore off I guess, and I didn't start again until I was 17, at which point I began writing real songs. What I did instead for about 7 years was just write the titles and then imagine the rest of the song. We even formed an imaginary band at school, my fifth form mates and me. We were called Peculiar, and I appointed myself as chief imaginary songwriter. As I recall, I came up with pretty much all the track titles for an imaginary LP, complete with timings. The timings were very important. Having come of age in the era of the classic 2.5 minute pop song, I had an innate sense of the importance of brevity. I measured out my early life in 2.5 minute chunks. As the era rolled on and the songs grew longer, I also developed an understanding of the relationship, not always a compatible one, between quantity and quality. If a track clocked in at 7 minutes 11 or 3 minutes 58, that told you a lot about its breadth and intent, or rather it told me a lot. For this was entirely an internal code which only I could crack. It was probably inspired by all that time gazing at record sleeves while I was listening to the music. Peculiar broke up after only a few summer weeks. Our lack of musical instruments and indeed perceivable musical talent proved to be an unresolvable obstacle when it came to taking the dream to the next stage. But some small part of me carried on dreaming until the dream became a reality and then eventually subsided back into dream again. Like a lot of pop kids, I dreamed of being in a band. At the time, I had no notion that this would ever come to pass, but the dream itself was rich fuel for fantasy and the imagined life. The imagined life is, after all, where a lot of teenagers spend their time. When I reached my early 20s, I got to live the dream. What I discovered was that there were far less sound checks in my dreams. The dream, in fact, was far more interesting than the reality. And now I'm through the other side of all that, I discover that my aesthetic has gone full circle, and that I'm back to imagining the songs again without writing them. I think I can guess where this impulse originally sprang from. From about the age of 12, I was an avid reader of the pop press, and each week in my music papers, the New Musical Express as it was known then, and Record Mirror, a full page was dedicated to the new record releases. These were the years when my information input far exceeded what I actually had access to. As a result, those record reviews were as much a forum for my fantasies, desires and dream associations as any group photo or interview or appearance on the television or radio. Some of the discs that were reviewed became lifelong or fortnight-long favourites. Some will be aired once on the radio before disappearing into the BBC-monopolised ether, never to be heard again. Others were never heard by me at all at the time. I only got to hear them when they were disinterred as cult objects 20 or 30 years later. During 1968 and 1969, when I was 13, 14, I would gaze at names like Cherry Smash or Tintin Abbey or Toby Twirl and try and imagine from the group name and song title alone what they sounded like. Those weekly lists took on a typographical life of their own and fed into my pop consciousness in ways that had little to do with taste or fandom. The review pages for me were a neutral zone of non-judgmental contemplation. And the best bit was, the following week it would start all over again. By the time the next edition of NME or Record Mirror arrived pristine and neatly folded through my letterbox on a Thursday morning, the pages had been refreshed and replenished, and there in front of me would be another 40 or 50 new releases, ripe and ready for appropriation and dream association. This ritual went on week in, week out for the best part of my early teens, days of innocence before experience. And looking back, I suspect that this was the reason that music became such a forum for my own fantasy life. I want to stress again that this has little to do with conventional fandom. I didn't particularly want to be in any of these groups. I couldn't ever imagine meeting them. The practicalities of the pop life were beyond me. I just wanted to invest them with mythology. Later, much later, I drifted into the world of music journalism for a while, and this flexible aesthetic came a bit of a handicap. I found that popular music history has its own foundation myths, lazily conceived in many cases, but rigidly adhered to nevertheless, and half the time, I didn't find that they were anything like as interesting as my own mythos. Rock music likes to build reality out of the unsubstantiated. I preferred to take what was there and weave something more interesting out of flimsy fabric. There was, shall we say, a conflict of interests. I've never been that interested in the mundane details of rock chronology, when bands formed and split up, lineup changes, what record label they were on, and all that other stuff men do when they wear their knowledge competitively. I tried to join in with that boy's own world of facts and info for a while, and because I spent far more time at school listening to pop music than listening to my teachers, I've accumulated quite a repository of pop knowledge about that period in my life. But that's never been enough for me, and I soon tire of its superficiality. And I've never been that good at the purely quantitative anyway, the price of everything and the value of nothing and all that. Even now I'd be hard-pressed to tell you the names of any members of those obscure 1960s bands that I loved so much. I'm interested in genealogy, but it's the genealogy of ideas that sparks my imagination. Not who did what, when and why, the why is usually conjecture anyway. Much more fun to make something up. And so that's what I do. Like all fiction writers, I invent characters and then give them a backstory and a life. Some of my fictional characters happen to be creative artists, which entails giving them a repertoire and a back catalogue. Now that I'm all grown up and intellectually equipped, I realise that the other key influence in all of this was what I shall call the grid. Here I shall cite Roland Barthes for validation. Barthes, when he became disillusioned with semiology, said, "In the beginning, it was a grid. And I myself tried to make it into one. But when it had become a grid, it didn't turn up anything else." That's pretty much how I feel about semiology, and about classificatory systems in general. They are useful for putting things in boxes, if putting things in boxes is your thing, but beyond that, they don't serve much of a purpose. I realise now that the pop charts were my earliest classificatory grid. I loved the symmetry of the pop chart, the way it changed every week. The way it seemed to be a living organic thing, when all it was, in fact, was a way of measuring over-the-counter purchases. Again, this has little to do with fandom or subjectivity. The pop charts were an utterly self-contained reality that could be read as a text like any other classificatory grid, the football league tables, for instance, or the racing pages. When I started buying music papers, I was fascinated to see all the other information that ran alongside the chart. How many weeks a record had been on the chart, highest position achieved. When I first bought NME in 1967, I was amazed to see that the Sound of Music soundtrack LP had been on the chart for something like 125 weeks. But that's all just facts and info, quaint to marvel at but soon disregarded. What I absorbed most was the verbal juxtapositions of the pop chart, what Roland Barthes, quoting Bertolt Brecht, referred to as the next two. To see completely disparate musical styles and artists all mixed up like that, that all informed my fiction later on too. There is a simple joy in making up a band name and then putting it next to another made-up band name just to see what the juxtaposition evokes. I've always been fascinated by band names, the way some date and some don't, the way some conjure a mental image, which is then instantly confirmed or dispelled the moment you hear the group in question. If you didn't know, for instance, that Echo and the Bunnymen was a Liverpool group that made cool glacial music of epic grandeur in the 1980s, you might reasonably assume that they were the somewhat gimmicky entry for the Eurovision Song Contest from Belgium or Finland. Calling a band the Smiths was a masterstroke. The name can justify itself purely on its own terms. Notionally neutral, it is therefore limitless in its possibilities. And that's how it works with fictional bands too. They can sound however you want them to sound. Where do I get my fictional band names from? Anywhere and everywhere. They come from misheard words and phrases, typos and misprints, compound words, conflated terms, chance encounters. I even took one from Burgess's novel, The Urchins of Deadcast, as you ask, but please don't ask again, as I want the others to remain a mystery, a puzzle that only you, the reader, can solve. There is a conceptual precedence for all this. I'm under no illusion that there's anything particularly unique in what I do. As I've got older and developed my writing techniques, my dream and draw approach to the pop life has been increasingly informed by Dada and Found Objects, by Brian Gysin and William Burroughs cut-up techniques, and by the unrealised utopias of surrealism and situationism. That line of development also finds contemporary form in fan fiction, experimental films, slash videos, and cut-and-paste culture in general. There are also antecedents in the music world. In 1969, Rolling Stone magazine concocted a hoax band called the Masked Marauders, said to be some of the most famous pop stars on the planet, Mick Jagger, Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, etc., working under a pseudonym due to contractual reasons. A spoof record review was written to go with the hoax. In fact, so attractive did the record sound, and so much music industry interest did it generate, that a band called the Masked Marauders was immediately formed to give substance to the dream. This was, of course, a huge mistake and a conceptual step too far. Rule one of Dream Club is that you never form an actual dream club. In the early 1990s, the writer William Boyd, with the assistance and helpful endorsement of David Bowie and Gore Vidal, invented an imaginary artist called Nat Tate. The name was a knowing conflation of the National and Tate Galleries. Boyd's fictitious artist was thoughtfully conceived and fulfilled all the requirements of the enigmatic mystery man. To the unsuspecting, his biography would have seemed entirely plausible. A short life lived in relative obscurity, an only child, an absent father, a series of paintings of bridges, most of which Tate subsequently destroyed, and ultimately that most convenient escape route for the fictitious painter, a suicide in 1960, when Tate jumped off the Staten Island ferry. Tate's fictitious career was launched, appropriately enough, on April 1, 1998, at the New York studio of artist Jeff Koons. David Bowie gave the event added credence by reading eloquent passage from the launch catalogue. The project was mischievous rather than malicious. There was no great attempt to fool the art world, and few were fooled anyway, although significantly, several people at the launch claimed to have heard of Tate even when they hadn't met the man himself. Nat Tate, 1928 to 1960, was a fun idea that quickly ran its course. But for a brief buoyant moment, that fun idea rang with plausibility. It's the plausibility that is the vital factor here. It seems to me that if you are going to invent fictional music or a fictional band or artist, they should sound as believable as any other fictional character. Strangely enough, I don't find the fictional artist in Anthony Burgess's original 1962 novel of Clockwork Orange half as convincing as the unheard bands in Kubrick's film. Perhaps it is precisely because some of them are heard in the book that makes them less appealing. I find Burgess's attempts at song fiction very inauthentic, but then Burgess did have a fairly low opinion of many aspects of popular culture, and that comes across all too clearly in his portrayals of Bert Lasky singing You Blister My Paint, or in the occasional bursts of mawkish ballads from far-off sentimental days. Burgess's withering portrayal of popular music is consistent with his disdain for Admas and the empty-headed Dvotchkas who are its most devoted recipients. Another good example of the problems faced by fictional creativity can be found in Joyce Carey's 1944 novel The Horse's Mouth and Ronald Neame's subsequent 1956 film adaptation starring Alec Guinness. Although here there is a reversal of the Burgess-Kubrick dilemma, with Carey's book offering a far better evocation of a painter's work than the film. Masterful though Alec Guinness is in the role of artist Gully Jimson, he is burdened by the physical realisation of his craft. Kitchen sink realist John Bratby painted the pictures used in the film, and they give substance, again as rooted in time as the Kubrick-Burgess band names, to what in the book is mostly left to the imagination. For at least half of the novel, Gully Jimson does no painting at all, and when he does, he only paints impulsively in fits and starts, and rarely completes anything. Painting largely plays a secondary role to the articulation of Gully's moral universe, and to more pressing concerns like his survival instincts, his impoverishment, his recidivism, and ultimately his prevarication and inability to create his masterwork. In fact, The Horse's Mouth makes the most convincing case for artist block I've ever read. But in the film, Alec Guinness is obligated by the conditions of his medium. He has to be seen to be living out the day-to-day practicalities of his craft. He has to be seen painting. And although I love Alec Guinness and love that film, each daub of pigment diminishes the best thing about the book, the fact that the art itself is mostly left to our and to Gully's imagination. In the novel, you never truly get a sense of what Gully is trying to achieve in his attempt to break free of Impressionism. I could never quite figure if his unrealised vision was figurative or abstract. I always imagined the style of the final mural to lie somewhere between Russian agitprop and Stanley Spencer, but that's just my interpretation. And it's interpretation that is the key here. Fictional art lends itself to a multitude of possibilities, possibilities of creation and possibilities of response. Carey thought on a deep conceptual level about all that too. He wrote several essays on the role of the artist and their work, and in the introduction to the 1957 edition of The Horse's Mouth, he cast just enough daylight on magic when he said, "I'm afraid I had no idea of Gully's style and didn't want one. If I had fixed him to a style, he would have become a period piece and not simply the original artist. His tragedy is universal. I didn't want to fix it to the particular." All of that seems key to me and informs my own work. The avoidance of the particular, the reduction to a time and place. In 1994, I was thrilled to read of a writer called Doug Kahn, who proposed the idea of conceptual instruments and something that he called theoretical music, i.e. music that doesn't exist. Obviously, this chimed with my own interests. My music fiction exists entirely on that same conceptual plane. The writer of the piece, featured in a book called Incredibly Strange Music Volume 2, was San Francisco artist Ken Sitz. Sitz cited the utopianism of the Soviet Union in the post-revolutionary period, the idea for a concerto for factory whistles, for example, which, like the Tatlin Tower and all the other utopian dreams of that post-1917 era, was never actually realised. Sitz also proposed a publication that prints reviews of art shows and performances that never actually happened. He mentioned in passing that in conjunction with a friend of his, Lisa Manin, he was working on an entirely fictional film festival catalogue that would list films, complete with plot synopsis, designed, as he put it, to be read by people too busy or isolated to actually attend them. I tried Googling this project, but although Sitz still seems to be active as a sound artist, there was no mention that paired him with Elisa Manin, and sadly no mention of the fictitious film catalogue either. The project, it would appear, like the utopian artworks he cites as inspiration, never happened. Which adds another layer of conceptual bluff, of course, the imagined fiction. I can remember how excited I was to chance upon the thoughts of Ken Sitz in Volume 2 of Incredibly Strange Music, a book that itself brims with ideas and artifacts that lay way outside of the mainstream of cultural consumerism, and indeed mainstream cultural critique. Reading Ken Sitz's eloquent articulations of the unrealised and the unrealisable helped me take my own thinking on these matters onto another conceptual level. For this isn't just an arid intellectual exercise or just another playful postmodernist conceit. It's a celebration of that whole other fantasy discourse that informs our engagement with the culture we love. After all, we all spend a great proportion of our time reading book reviews of books we will never read, film reviews of films we will never watch, and record reviews of songs we will never listen to. So it's only a small conceptual step to do away with a genuine artifact completely and replace it with a counterfeit. In a novel I have been working on recently, I have a whole cast of characters who are engaged in creative activity. The central character is a classically trained piano player, but there is also a rich supporting cast of creatives, including a filmmaker, a scriptwriter, a set designer, and a fashion designer. As a result, my own engagement with imagined artworks has moved on to a whole new level. I've had to increase my imaginary output for starters. In the new novel, I describe imaginary films, the imaginary sets that go with them, and sometimes the imaginary aesthetic behind them. I give the classically trained piano player commissions and compositions that have to sit comfortably alongside the non-fictional classical canon that we're all familiar with. And perhaps most challenging of all, I invent imaginary fashions. Inventing a look is far harder than inventing music. The latter can get by on title, allusions and adjectives. The former has to be tangible and plausible. Perhaps the greatest paradox in all of this is that the imagined has to ring true. None of it works otherwise. Unless you are just engaged in savage satire or high camp, you can't spoof it. The imagined artwork has to take on all the cultural baggage of the real one. Hollywood movies are full of bad fictional bands that don't look convincing. I am a connoisseur of such disasters, and this obsession, I admit, does locate itself firmly in the realms of the kitsch and the camp. But then I've read my Susan Sontag, and I know the territory well. And seeing it done badly, unintentionally badly on most occasions, sharpens you up as a writer to do it well. Which brings me nicely to the second golden rule of Dream Club, which is that fictional musicians should not spend a great deal of their time talking about music. A few years back, I read Ishiguro's Nocturnes, Five Stories of Music and Nightfall. I enjoyed the Nightfall element far more than I enjoyed the music. The mood of the characters in the interlinked short stories is often implicit and alluded to. The music, however, is often made explicit, as the author, somewhat self-consciously I thought at times, shoehorned in whole passages of procedure and technical information. It's just a question of personal preference, I suppose, but for me it reeks of overkill, of over-asserting the research, and it jarred with the musicality of the stories themselves, which were exquisite miniatures, lyrical in themselves, and never in need of superfluous articulation. I sometimes think that people who haven't been in bands, or film producers or writers who are trying to convey the authenticity of being in a band, vastly overrate the importance that musicians attribute to their craft. They certainly overrate the degree to which they willingly articulate it. From my considerable experience in this area, I suspect that musicians spend no more of their free time talking about music than plumbers spend talking about plumbing. I once knew a football agent who told me exactly the same thing about professional footballers. In their spare time, they rarely watch football on the TV. Why would they? They spend every minute of their professional working lives playing and practicing football. What would be the appeal in watching others do it? When I was doing the groundwork for my classically trained musician, I sought out the advice of a colleague, an academy-trained classical musician. I ran everything by her for plausibility: the daily life of a music academy, the timetable, the internal politics of the classical world, and most importantly, musical terminology, always a minefield for a non-musician, and more importantly, an unschooled readership. The one thing we were both adamant about was that musicians, on their time off, don't sit around talking about the complexity of this particular Beethoven movement, or the tempo or mood of that particular Bach partita, What do they talk about instead? They talk about life. They talk about where they're going to find a curry house in Copenhagen at 1 o'clock in the morning. They bitch about who is screwing who, figuratively or physically. They engage in the mundane daily realities we all deal in. And that's where you have to invest the fiction too, not in endless tedious discourse about the imaginary music. That's just trying too hard. As evidence, my classical colleague forwarded on an email she had just received from a friend who was currently on tour with an orchestra. He spoke of being tired and of not being able to get a shower after the concert he had just given, and was now going out on the town with stinking armpits. And the language he used to convey all this was far more fruity than the language I have just used in the retelling. As a writer, I don't like laying it on with a trowel. I want the reader to do some work. Most importantly, I want to give the reader some space in the novel that they can inhabit freely and invest with their own thoughts and interpretations, just as I did all those years ago with my Record Mirrors and my NMEs and all those record releases I'd never heard. And what can be inhabited more freely than music that doesn't exist? Once I've given you a title, the tune is up to you.
That was Rob Chapman. You can find out more about Rob on his website at www.rob-chapman.com. And that concludes episode 165, which was recorded by John Siddiq and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 166, we feature the second part of James McConaughey's interview with Tobias Jones. Here, Tobias speaks with James about his lifelong fascination with communal living, the secrets of making it work, and his own experience in establishing and nurturing a residential community. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.